When I think back to my childhood, I have zero memories being content in a female body. It was so deeply ingrained in me that I just really felt like I wasn't complete unless I was a boy. Around fourth grade, I heard about these things called sex change operations that today, you know, they're calling it gender affirmation or what, gender confirmation. But I was like, are you kidding me? Like, you can go to the hospital one day as Linda and come out the next day as David. My little 9-year-old old heart was, I thought in my juvenile mind, that's how it worked, and I could just go do that.
I talk a lot about the need for shepherding the hearts of our sons and daughters, and that's not an unusual theme. I speak about it a lot because I feel like it's one of the areas that we as Christians, and especially Christian fathers, stumble in over and over and over again.
If I had had people to help me, coach me, if I knew I wasn't the only one, I could watch videos, if I was in today's culture, I would have transitioned in a heartbeat. And unfortunately, I think I would have come to the conclusion that rearranging the skin on my body did nothing to resolve the anguish in my soul.
I also would love for you to comment on this dynamic that I'm seeing a lot of in culture and seeing a lot of this in social media, where children are just so quick now to adult children many times to completely cut their parents off.
We live in a fallen world and the enemy capitalizes on those deficits.
Yes.
And really much of my healing came from not only naming what the deficits are, but also repenting for my wrong responses to my parents' best intentions. They did the best they could. One of my pastors said, you know, Linda, you get hurt in relationship and you get healed in relationship.
Yep.
And all of that just takes time.
Welcome to the Love and Truth Network podcast, your guide for hope and healing in a hurting world searching for truth. Here we explore God's extraordinary design for biblical sexuality, identity, and authentic community. You'll be impacted by incredible stories of transformation, practical wisdom from pastors and counselors, and the power of God's grace that changes lives.
Well, hey, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the Love and Truth Network podcast. We're glad that you're here with us, and I'm excited for you to meet someone who is a ministry leader, someone that I get to call a friend as well. Linda Seiler, Dr. Linda Seiler, has just her history and her story are going to be really incredible. If you've not heard her story yet, I hope in some ways you haven't, because I hope it unfolds as a first time for you. But I've known her for many years in ministry circles and just really appreciated the way that God has been at work in her life, the way that she has yielded to the Lord. And I often refer to Linda Seiler as a powerhouse in the Assemblies of God, but of course, outside of that too, in many denominations. And she really is, I think, a force to be reckoned with in some of the areas that we're going to be talking about today, particularly in the LGBTQ space, for sure. I say a force to be reckoned with. I love how Linda communicates with such truth, but also really communicates with compassion, helps the church embrace both of those perspectives and try to weave those in to the way that we minister, not just in the LGBT space, outside of that as well, but also in that area. So Linda, I'm so glad that you were able to join us today for this episode recording.
Thanks, Gary. Great to be with you.
Thanks so much. And I would love for you, Linda, just to share with our audience, those that are watching, those that are listening, just your story. Just feel free to take 15, 20 minutes, whatever you need to unpack some of that. I might jump in a little bit and ask some questions in the midst of it, but typically most of that stuff will come at the end of when you finish sharing your story.
Sure. Yeah. I grew up in the 1970s when our culture was totally different than it is now. And I felt like a little boy trapped in a female body. I didn't know there was a word for that. I didn't know anybody else on planet Earth felt that way. It was just my subjective experience. And so I was, you know, really attaching to my dad and imitating him, rejected my mom at a young age. I just judged her as emotional and just weak. And I didn't want to be a part of the world of woman for whatever reason.
But I want our audience to understand, like, this started really young for you. Like, when did it first begin?
Oh, for me, when I think back to my childhood, I have zero memories being content in a female body. There are pictures of me as a young kid where, you know, mom would dress you in whatever, but as soon as I could start exerting my will and what I wanted, Yeah, I have zero memories. I just always felt like this little boy. So, you know, however early your memories go back to, age three, you know, I don't know. But for me, it literally felt like I was born that way. So, it, you know, people ask me, are you born? Yeah, well, that was my subjective experience, even though the science doesn't bear that out, but sure felt that way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I just grew up feeling trapped in my body, and remember when I was probably 5-6 years old out playing with kids, and we were talking about, somebody mentioned this idea of reincarnation, that you could come back in the next life as something else. And I remember making a vow, you know, as soon as, if that's me and I'm my dying wish is going to be, make me a boy, let me come back in the next life as a boy. Of course, I wasn't a believer at the time, and I didn't know how all that stuff works, but it was so deeply ingrained in me that I just really felt like I wasn't complete unless I was a boy. So as I was growing up and feeling these things, I was in the fourth grade, and a little boy at school pushed me, as a joke, pushed me into the boys' restroom, and I saw this wall of urinals, and I was like, what? What is that? And I didn't know, we didn't have those in the girls' bathroom. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what is that? And he explained. And that became like a symbol of the forbidden world that I desperately longed to be a part of. And from that point forward, I began visiting men's restrooms, pretending to use a urinal, and men would walk in and out. I looked so much like a boy. Nobody batted an eye. And for me, it was the most exhilarating feeling that, like, yes, you know who I really am, and I belong here, and this is me, you know? And that endured into adulthood, and that became, as my sexual, you know, my hormones and kind of sexual desires kicked in, it turned into a sexual fetish of sorts, where it was just the most exhilarating high to visit men's restrooms, which I know is weird, but, like, the very sight of a urinal was, like, a triggering thing to me. And so then as around fourth grade, I heard about these things called sex change operations that today, you know, they're calling it gender affirmation or what, gender confirmation. But I was like, are you kidding me? Like, you can go to the hospital one day as Linda and come out the next day as David. Sign me up. As soon as I have enough money and I'm old enough to make that decision, like, this, my little 9-year old heart was, I thought in my juvenile mind, that's how it worked. And I could just go do that. Mm-hmm. I knew nothing about, at that time, you had to live as the opposite sex for 2 years and do hormone treatment and all, and get a counselor, you know, go to a psychiatrist or whatever. And there were all sorts of prerequisites that they don't have today. But I didn't know how all that worked. I just, in my juvenile mind, I literally thought, just go get the surgery, come out of the hospital the next day as David, and live happily ever after. I had no clue. And I'm, quite frankly, I'm glad that I didn't grow up in a generation that had YouTube. And I wasn't in a permissive culture where all this was normalized, because if it were, and I could just get on YouTube and watch these videos of other women injecting testosterone and the mesmerizing changes that they go through, their voices getting deeper, you know, growing a beard and just, you know, masculinizing their mm-hmm. body, I would have done that in a heartbeat if somebody could have shown me the way. So I'm grateful I didn't grow up in a culture where that was a possibility for me. So I'm navigating all these things in my head, just fighting it. I didn't fit in with the girls. I wasn't officially one of the guys, but, you know, I'm out on the playground playing flag football with the guys instead of Barbies with the girls. And, you know, I didn't want to be a part of the girl world. But I just didn't fit in. I just always was different and just felt deep wounds of rejection and all sorts of things. And so I just began to really hate myself and became, you know, suicidal in junior high, just trapped in this body and miserable. And so in around, I don't know, sixth grade, whenever your hormones and stuff kind of kick in, I discovered one day there was a teacher that was paying particular attention to me. And I didn't know it at the time, but like I became like kind of her favorite, and she gave me a nickname. And now I know in hindsight, she was grooming me and just, you know, giving me inappropriate attention. And it was confusing me because the thing she was doing with me was, it felt good, but it was not right. And so it she was my first attraction. Like I experienced like these feelings towards her and I didn't know what it was. And then when I figured out what was happening, I was like, oh no. And of course that was in 1980s and nobody was talking about this. And so thank God there was no LGBTQ club or safe zone or, you know, people that would help override my conscience. I was not a believer at the time, but I knew it was wrong. I knew like something about this is disordered. I don't want this, but I mean, it just feels like I'm born this way and I can't, you know, I didn't choose it. So I'm fighting with these things going, why am I feeling this? And why are all the other girls around me feeling attractions to boys? So I'm trying to reason what's going on. I can't tell my family because I didn't come from a family where we talk openly about those kinds of things. And so I'm alone. I'm on my own trying to figure out my reality. And I thought, you know, if I really am a man trapped in a female body, then these attractions to women make sense. That just makes me a straight man. So I just need to hold out until I can get this surgery. And then the stars will align and I'll, you know, find a woman and marry and live happily ever after. And, you know, end of story. So as I got into late junior high, I'm thinking through things in a way you don't have the capacity to think through as a 9-year-old. And I'm starting to think through, like, what are my parents going to think? What would my sister think? What are the neighbors going to think? What are my grandparents going to think? You know, different generation.
Right.
And quite frankly, I was just so terrified of anybody knowing these feelings and what was going on behind closed doors. I had all sorts of sexual addictions and things going on because I had some friends that exposed me to pornography at a very young age, 9, 10 years old, whatever. And it awakened things in me. And I was fixated on those images of men. I wanted to be the man with the woman, not the woman with the man. And so I'm dealing with all this stuff behind. Nobody knows. And
yep.
I think if my parents had known, they would have tried to help me if they could. But just I fooled a whole lot of people and nobody knew. And so I'm thinking through these, like, how am I going to do this? And I remember the day I'm walking down the hallway in junior high, and I'm weighing the options. And I thought, you know, I could run away, have the surgery, live happily ever after, be David and end of story. Or I could not have the surgery, keep my family, but know that it would consign me to this life of, you know, struggle and despair and suicidal ideation and all of that and loneliness. But as I thought through it, I was like, you know my family loves me. And the thought of, even if I get to be David, but I live the rest of my life kind of alone, you know, I don't know that I would want that. And so I consciously chose option B. Like, it was this thought process, like, you know what, Linda, this is what you just have to do to survive. And again, if I had had people to help me, coach me, if I knew I wasn't the only one, I could watch videos. If I was in today's culture, I would have transitioned in a heartbeat. And unfortunately, I think I would have come to the conclusion that rearranging the skin on my body did nothing to resolve the anguish in my soul.
Yes.
And yeah. I may have ended up in a worse place. Who knows? Mm-hmm. I mean, only God knows. But
let me just ask a question right there and come back, put a pin right there for a moment and come back to this. That you would have, again, as I think I would have at one time in my life as well, if transgenderism and all this had been a part of my early teen years as well. But the thing I'm wondering about is, like, I talk a lot about the need for shepherding the hearts of our sons and daughters, and that's not an unusual theme. I speak about it a lot because I feel like it's one of the areas that we as Christians, and especially Christian fathers, stumble in over and over and over again. Like, we don't even know how in any way to shepherd the hearts of our children. We know how to do behavior management, but we don't know how to shepherd their hearts. And so, like, it kills me on the inside to listen to you talk about what you were wrestling with and for no one to know about that. Like, I can't imagine my boys, like, not knowing what was going on in their hearts. I mean, I don't need to know every nook and cranny, and kids do need some privacy for sure. But what you're talking about is this deep, pervasive ache and pain and longing that nobody knows about. So can you speak to that idea of shepherding the hearts of children as parents, as fathers, especially moms too? And I know there's no way of going back and saying, well, if I'd had this kind of conversation or an ongoing conversation about these things with my parents, but you don't know for sure, but what would you have liked to have kind of happened, and how could you perceive that as having been helpful from early ages, the early part of your life?
Oh my goodness, great question. I read a book recently called Sacred Attachment by Michael Cusick, and he talks about how every child, it's a book that's based on like attachment theory with John Bowlby,
yes.
Bowlby, and applying it to our relationship with God. And to the degree that we attach with people in the natural, to that degree, it becomes easy to attach with God. So that, you know, scripture talks about from birth, I was from my mother's womb, you taught me to trust in you, even at my mother's breast. From birth, I was cast on you. From from my mother's womb, you've been my God. Mm. And there's this idea that, you know, we learn trust through those natural relationships, and then it shows us how to trust God. But if that trust is broken, and Michael describes it in his book with the four S's, every child needs to be seen, soothed, safe, and secure. And to the degree we experience that in our natural relationships, to that degree we begin to experience it with God. So as I read his book and he described what it means to be seen and soothed, safe, secure, I realized in my subjective experience, wow, I didn't get any of that. Like, despite my parents' best intentions, they did the best they could with what they had. And unfortunately, there were things that happened to them in their life and a lot of brokenness that, you know, it just never was resolved. And so they never felt seen, soothed, safe, secure. So how can you give what you don't have? And so what I wish would have happened in my life was, as I'm going through junior high and I was struggling with depression. I didn't know it at the time, but I mean, just depressed, despairing, lonely, and a lot of frustration. I had a really bad temper and a lot of anger coming out. And I wish one of my parents would have sought me out and said, wow, you seem kind of, disheartened today. Tell me more about that. Or when I go angry up to my room and slam the door, you know, come seeking me out and yep. Exploring my heart and saying, wow, it sounds like you seem kind of frustrated today. Tell me about your day. What's going on? How you feeling? And like helping me process that. But instead, I just came from a family where we just had a lot of dysfunction, not knowing how to navigate those kinds of conversations. And to my parents' credit, I don't think they ever experienced that in their, you know, upbringing. And so they didn't know how to give that.
Uh-huh.
And so feeling like I was not seen, though I was, my parents, again, did the best they could with what they had and they provided for me. Was never in want as far as, you know, being fed and clothed and education and just all the things.
Yep.
And I know they loved me. So there was never any doubt about that. They did the best with what they had. It wasn't until I was an adult that I realized, oh my goodness, I actually grew up as emotionally as an orphan. Like they were physically present, but emotionally absent, unable to connect with my deepest needs. To the point where as a kid, I would go to a friend's house and see somebody else's mother and be like, I want her mom to be my mom. And I didn't have words for it. I was like, there's something missing in my relationship here. But you seem to have that with your mom and I want that. Now I know it's that connection. It's the being seen and soothed and safe and secure. And when I experienced same-sex attractions, actually in the beginning, it wasn't sexual. In the beginning, I just wanted one of my teachers in junior high to see me. I just wanted her to notice me. I wanted her to pay attention to me. I wanted her to hug me. I wanted her to like meet my needs emotionally. And it wasn't a sexual thing until my hormones kicked in. And then those emotional relational deficits got confused.
Yes.
With my very normal, natural, God-given desires. And because I hadn't passed that developmental milestone of just becoming secure as a female in a female body and as one of the girls who belongs with the girls.
Mm-hmm.
And until you, if you don't pass that developmental milestone, you spend the rest of your life searching for it. And so I spent much of my adulthood searching, like not knowing who I was as a woman, rejecting the world of woman, trying to identify as a man, you know, being with the world of man, being something I wasn't designed to be, and a just constant frustration and not knowing all of this could be traced, like breadcrumbs traced back to this broken relationship with my own parents, who did the best they could, but just there was a gaping deficit that the enemy took advantage of and capitalized on.
Yeah, I so agree with what you're saying, and I relate very much in my own story with exactly what you're talking about there. One of the things that I really appreciate also, you've said it 3, 4, maybe 5 times, that your parents did the best they could, you know, and so I want to jump back to where you left off with your story. But before we do, I also would love for you to comment on this dynamic that I'm seeing a lot of in culture, and seeing a lot of this in social media, where children are just so quick now to adult children many times to completely cut their parents off, to be in, whether they're going to counseling and they're basically picking up this idea that everything is mom and dad's fault. And it just becomes this easy thing to, I don't know if it's scapegoating our own personal responsibility. I think part of it's that. There's probably other things too, but where it's all about mom and dad's fault, as if they should have been able to do something perfectly, rather than recognizing, yep, they did a lot of things that were unhealthy. And also, it's important for us as adults to acknowledge what we didn't get. We're not talking about pretending that everything was wonderful. We need to acknowledge what we didn't get. And sometimes that's really hard to do, but at the same time, to offer forgiveness and also offer understanding for where they came from and what they did give to us that was so good. What are your thoughts about that before we jump back to your story?
Yes. You know, I like what Cy Rogers used to say, that this is about naming, not blaming. This is about acknowledging where deficits were, but we live in a fallen world and the enemy capitalizes on those deficits.
Yes.
And really much of my healing came from not only naming what the deficits are, but also repenting for my wrong responses to my parents' best intentions. They did the best they could, but there were some deficits there. And I judged them. I had to take ownership for what was in my heart and my wrong responses, while acknowledging, you know, what was there. And there are things they're responsible for too, right?
Right.
But much of my healing, even now, as both my parents are 85 and dealing with dementia, and just it's sad just watching what's going on as they're kind of losing their cognitive. They're just becoming a shadow of who they used to be, and it's just heartbreaking. But just recognizing like the pain they've been through and seeing what was missing in their life and why they couldn't give me what I needed. And it just wasn't, they had the best intentions, and I can't blame them. It's not their fault. It can't be distilled down to one thing as to why I struggled the way I did. If it could, it'd be an easy fix. But our sexuality is complicated. Our relationships are layered. We're dealing with the world, the flesh, and the devil, and all sorts of factors that contribute to our sexuality. And those kinds of things don't develop overnight, and they don't resolve overnight. One of my pastors said, you know, Linda, you get hurt in relationship and you get healed in relationship.
Yep.
And all of that just takes time.
Yes.
And so I tell parents all the time, you know, my parents went through the same thing when they found out what I struggled with and all of that. They were blaming, what did we do wrong that our daughter turned out this way? And we feel so bad, and just kind of, you know, it's so easy to kind of fall inward into that. And I always encourage parents, hey, we're dealing with a fallen world, and your child's choices. I had choices as to how I could respond and the things I chose and whatever. And it's, again, just multifaceted and multilayered.
And that's right.
It's a really simplistic kind of junior high mindset. If you're going to be like, oh, it's all my parents' fault and cut them off and move on, that's just not how it works.
Yeah, it goes back to the cutting off your nose to spite your face, right? Like, you're missing out on all of the benefit of being close to and working at relationship with your parents as an adult child, and now you're just cutting them out of your life altogether. So I want to come back, though, to where you were talking about. I love the imagery of walking down the hallway, and I'm sure you can even remember that very clearly, because you're wrestling with those two polar perspectives of embracing this idea that you could become David, maybe, and that's the direction you're going to go in, but you're counting the cost, you're weighing it out. On the other hand, you're struggling with this, that what does this mean for you internally to continue wrestling with what you're wrestling with, but still remain attached to your parents and other factors too, I'm sure. And at the end, you chose the latter. That's kind of where you left off when I jumped in.
Yeah, I decided this is just what I have to do to survive. And so from that point forward, I was like, you know, I was very androgynous at that point looking. And so I thought, you know, I should probably take some cues from my older sister, grow my hair out a little bit, not be so, you know, kind of androgynous. So I get into high school and my attractions, which again, initially started with just older kind of mother figure type women that it wasn't sexual. And then it gravitated to becoming sexual. And then my attractions started gravitating toward my peers. And I'm trying desperately not to act on them, because in that day and age, if you did, you were made fun of and ostracized. And I didn't want anybody to know what was going on. So I had this elaborate, you know, fantasy world and things going on behind closed doors. And played sports, tried, you know, I'm sure in locker rooms and hotel rooms and everything. And it just became increasingly difficult. So my junior year in high school, I decided maybe I'm not attracted to boys because I'm not dating. And maybe I should go to that turnabout dance where the girls invite the guys and invite this guy from my physics class. So I did. And wore a dress, borrowed a dress from my sister. I had grown my hair out. I was wearing a little light makeup, some nail polish. Like, I was doing everything I knew to do to play the part and fit the role. And that was my first of many attempts to try to date guys, hoping it would like awaken something in me that's dormant, that just, you know, hasn't, yes, right, you know, blossomed yet. You know, yep, maybe I'm a late bloomer or something, you know. And it didn't. It just made me more jealous. I wanted to be the man with the woman, not the woman with the man. And I felt, went to prom both years, wore the same dress, just borrowed a dress from my sister, just whatever I have to do. And I just felt like a man dressed in drag. It was like I was wearing a costume to try to fit in and play a role that I was completely uncomfortable in my own body.
Yeah.
And I just despised, you know, the body I was in, and I was miserable. So around my junior year, a friend invited me to a Youth for Christ outreach in downtown Chicago. And I thought, well, yeah, I'll go to your Christian outreach. I'm a Christian. I go to a church. I didn't know at the time that the church I went to was not preaching the gospel. It was more of a social gospel.
Yep.
If you work enough soup kitchens and help little old ladies across the street, you have a good shot at being saved through your good works. Mm-hmm. So I go to this outreach. I hear the gospel for the first time. And all of a sudden, like, nobody had to tell me I deserve judgment for my sin. I was well convicted of all the stuff going on behind closed doors. And I had heard Jesus died on the cross for your sins, but I never knew what that meant. And all of a sudden that night I realized, oh my goodness, he took my sin upon himself. And he's offering me salvation as a free gift. And I can just receive it? I need this. And so they led everybody in a prayer and said, you know, pray this prayer in your heart if you want to receive Jesus. So I did. And then they invite everybody to go down front if you prayed that prayer. I wasn't moved. The church I went to, you do not move from your pew or, you know, any of that. And so I was like, I'm not
until
going down there.
Until they say amen. And yes.
Yeah. And I was like, my ride might leave without me. And of course, they would have waited for, they knew I was getting saved. They would have waited for me, but I didn't know how this worked. So I was glad I didn't go forward, because they took all the people into a side room, and who knows what they were doing back there, and that they're probably exactly abusing them back there. You know, they're just giving them a Bible and helping them walk with Jesus. So that said, nobody knew I received Jesus. Nobody knew I was a Christian now. And I thought I would wake up the next morning and all this stuff will go away, because if anyone's in Christ, they're a new creation. You know, the old is gone, the new is here. And I wake up the next morning and I'm still attracted to women. I still want to be a man. I'm like, oh, no. It didn't take. So I thought, well, I wasn't sincere enough when I prayed the prayer. So I went back, I don't know, every month they had that meeting, and I went back 5 or 6 times, each time more sincere that I'm really going to mean it this time. I had no understanding of justification, being saved, versus sanctification, walking that out, and temptation doesn't go away overnight, and transformation, and what the Bible calls progressive sanctification,
yes,
takes time. But I, you know, I didn't tell anybody I got saved, so nobody knew to disciple me in that. So I go away to college, and I get involved in a campus ministry, start reading the Bible for myself, and really started to grow in my relationship with Jesus. But I didn't tell anybody, you know, these desires of what was going on behind closed doors. I knew that, like, that's not okay. So this was 1991, and I kneel on my dorm room floor, and I said, God, there's something I need to tell you. As if he didn't know. I'm like, can you just, like, this, you know, I have these desires to be a man. I'm attracted to women. Can you just, like, just take this away? And then we don't ever have to tell anyone. Even if I get married, we don't ever have to tell anyone. Okay, amen. You know, and you and I both know almost everybody that's experienced these kinds of feelings has whether they're saved or not, they pray a prayer like that. Whether they believe in God or not, everybody's prayed that prayer like, please.
Well, actually, most Christians pray prayers like that because they don't want anyone to know whatever the stuff they're struggling with. It's like, let's just keep this between you and me and that's it, right? And of course, decades go by and they're still struggling. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, so I prayed that prayer. It didn't go down the way I was hoping. Otherwise, I wouldn't be on this podcast today. But yeah, so I pray that. I'm struggling my whole, you know, all 4 years in college. Get to my senior year, I'm miserable. I'm living a double life. So on the outside, I'm leading a Bible study. I was playing on the soccer team, but then I joined a sorority to kind of throw people off because I thought that was too butch to just be an athlete and not. So I joined the sorority. I'm the chaplain, you know, whatever, for the sorority. I'm leading a Bible study for that campus ministry. And they were actually recruiting me to come on staff with that ministry because they saw that I was, you know, growing in Jesus and serious. And I felt a genuine, like, call of God to do that. I wanted other people to come to know Jesus. But I was like, man, if they even knew what was going on behind closed doors. So it's Christmas break, my senior year in college. And I go away to this conference they have over the Christmas break. And I hear somebody speaking. I went to two breakouts. One was a breakout on homosexuality, which that was like cutting edge for the time. This was the 90s. This was 94.
That was gutsy for you to even go to it.
Yeah, well, okay, the way I went to it was my senior year in college, I was taking a human sexuality class as an elective, and I was doing my research paper on whether or not homosexuality is inborn.
Oh.
And because I wanted to know, I needed answers, because the narrative at that point in our culture was, oh, there's a gay gene. We've discovered, you know, there's a gene that makes people gay. You know, Dean Hamer's stuff and then Simon LaVey's stuff that, like, oh, we know there's a structure in your brain that, you know, from birth, it was on the cover of Newsweek. Like, we just know that it's determined from birth that this is, you know, the way your sexuality is going to go down. And so I was just really curious, like, can this stuff change, you know? And so I didn't want to be caught dead going to an elective like that and somebody guess what I was struggling with. So I told my small group leader and friends, like, you know, this is for my research, for my human sexuality class. I'm like, it's for me. So this guy was talking about, you know, your sexuality is formed at a young age, and experiences with our father and mother can contribute to our psychosexual development and so forth. And I was like, I have never heard this before. And I'm like, is that true? Is that possible? Is it? And I couldn't point to anything in my life because in my opinion, I was like, I just come from a perfect family because we, you know, my parents they weren't divorced. You know, there was no, like, you know, domestic abuse or alcoholism or like major, major, major things that I could point to. I didn't understand that, like, not being seen, soothed, safe, secure. I didn't even know that that was a thing and that I wasn't getting those needs met. So that just made me start questioning, like, is freedom possible? Could it be possible I could find help? And then I went to another elective on addiction and sin. And if you find yourself trapped in unrepentant, repetitive sin that you just can't get out of, the answer is James 5:16. Confess your sins one to another and pray for each other so that you may be healed. I didn't hear anything else they were saying. It was like the Holy Spirit took that verse and pierced my heart. And I just came to the conclusion, you know what? If freedom is possible, the answer is going to be taking what's in the dark and bringing it into the light with a trusted leader. And I couldn't tell my small group leader because I was madly attracted to her. She was on staff. And I was like, I can't talk to her about this. And so I asked my campus pastor, John, middle-aged man in his 40s with 5 kids. And I said, you know, could we talk? There's something I need to tell you. And he says, okay, well, I have responsibilities at this conference. Let's meet for breakfast in the lobby day after tomorrow. And okay, so I get in the elevator to go up to my hotel room, and I'm like, what did I just do? What did I just do? I set up an appointment to tell this middle-aged married man my sexual struggles. And I'm a leader in the group, and they're recruiting. He has no idea I'm living a double life. He's going to be so disappointed in me. He's going to reject me. He's going to kick me out of the group, expose my sin to everybody. This is a terrible decision.
And so did you ever stop to think about, like, what else could I come up with to talk to him about instead of this?
Oh, I wish that would have occurred. That did not occur to me.
Well, that's good. That's good.
That did not occur to me. What occurred to me was I can't get out of this because I already told him I need to tell him something.
Yeah.
And so there was only one way out in my mind. Yep. And I got up to my hotel room, which was near the top floor at the Westin Hotel there. And my other roommates, there were three other people in the room sharing the room, and they were all at breakouts. And I was like, you know what? The only way out is to take my life. And I just have a short amount of time before, I don't know who else, when they're coming back to the room. So I went over to the window and I looked down. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm jumping because this will be easy. I'll die of a heart attack before I hit the ground because it's so far down. And, you know, would you believe the windows don't open that far up, probably, for obvious reasons. And I looked at the desk chair. It was, like, made out of wood, and there was no way I was going to be able to break the window. So I go into the bathroom, and they had those little replacement razors for shaving. And I thought, yeah, I could take some of those and slit my wrist. I don't know how long it takes to bleed out. I've never done this before. I'm squeamish at the sight of blood. What if I pass out before I bleed out? What if my roommates come back before I finish? And I'm thinking through all of this. And of course, the whole time I am feeling such oppression that I didn't know about, you know, stuff from the enemy. Yep. I didn't know. But I'm like, I literally couldn't breathe. Like it was probably a panic attack too. And I just I was having difficulty breathing and just thinking through my mind like, oh man, what's happening here? And how am I going to do this? And do I want to do this? And thinking through, I'm not leaving a note. Like there's no way I was going to leave a note and anybody would ever know. And so I was thinking through the perspective of my family. Like, they'll have to go the rest of their lives not knowing why I took my life. But I'm not leaving a note. And that was really what kept me. Like, I knew as dysfunctional as my family is, they love me. And I didn't see my family as dysfunctional at that point. So that kind of kept me the next day and a half. And I get down to breakfast, and I wish it had occurred to me to lie to him and tell him there's something else I wanted to tell him. That just didn't even occur
great.
To me. So after an hour of, like, you know, painstaking small talk, he says, was there something in particular he wanted to talk about? I'm like, yeah, I'm having a hard time, telling you. And, so I tell him, and I'm inside, I am like flinching, I'm bracing, I'm waiting for the rejection. I have no idea how this man, I'm like, this is either going to be the worst decision of my life. The best decision if change is possible, and I'm desperate enough to find out.
Well, hey, everybody, thank you so much for joining us for part one of this episode of the Love and Truth Network podcast. Tune in next week to pick up part two of this same discussion.